Hello, this time on Sit Rep, as the Army's world-renowned Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, undergoes a radical process of modernisation, we get exclusive access to the people who are part of it. Also, the force's parents threatening to quit if they have to pay 20% VAT on school fees. We'll hear from an Army veteran who says military families are being betrayed. And unearthing the surprising true story of the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior.
Sit Rep.
With Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Welcome back, Mike. So much has happened since we last saw you. And before we get stuck in, just want your reflections on events in the Middle East. The UK military ready to evacuate Britons from Lebanon in the event of all-out war.
Yes, and it looks as if they may need to, because it's hard to imagine either side stepping back from that now. And we've got, apart from the 700 personnel going to Akrotiri in Cyprus, led by some Royal Marines, but there are also some civilians there, some Border Force personnel, and HMS Duncan, the very hard-working Type 45 destroyer, is on station, as is the Mounts Bay, which is a landing ship, so that's very useful to have in these situations. I was actually looking back at the last time we did this, 2006, in the last Israeli Hezbollah war, and it went very well. It was very well handled, but I was looking back at what we had. We sent the illustrious, the aircraft carrier, the Gloucester, the Bulwark, the York, the St. Albans, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, Fort Victoria, two squadrons of Fleet Air Arm helicopters, one squadron of RAF Chinooks. We did it in a pretty big way to lift off about the same number of people that will be processed one way or another if we end up doing it this time by the Duncan and the Mounts Bay. It's a little microcosm of the differences between what we had in 2006 and what we can deploy now.
Now, we're starting today with a unique focus on the Army's world-renowned Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, and its radical process to modernise. It's conducting what it calls a critical mass trial, huge efforts to ramp up the numbers of women in its platoons in response to a tragedy at the Academy. In 2019, a young officer cadet, Olivia Perks, took her own life, and the ensuing inquiry forced Sandhurst to face up to systemic failings in the delivery of safe and tough training. BFBS's Forces News has been given rare and exclusive access to Sandhurst as it embarks on transformation and has documented it in a new series. Rosie Layden is the series producer of Sandhurst Women Leading the Fight. And Rosie, great to see you. Thanks for joining us on Sit Rep. We can talk a little bit more about the background to all of this and the trial in a moment, but worth just mentioning to start with, Sandhurst opened its doors to you.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it was so interesting. There's not been a documentary or a film made there in such detail since 2012. So it was great to get inside, and lots of people listening will have heard of Sandhurst. They've probably even been to Sandhurst, many of them. But just to put it in context, it's worth pointing out there's been an officer training establishment on that exact site for over 200 years. Every officer in the British Army goes to Sandhurst to train. And the idea is they do the same course, that they believe that creates powerful traditions and shared experience and standardisation that then gets pushed out across the Army. So these young leaders commission and they take up command. So it's not an exaggeration to say that it's regarded as one of the best military training establishments in the world. People really do see it in those terms, within and outside the academy. So what they do here matters, basically. And what we were observing specifically over the 4 months we spent there is a critical mass trial. And that's designed not to recruit more women or to change entry standards in any way. It's just about balancing the genders of the men and women within certain platoons. So they went up from around 10% women to 30%. And here's a short clip of the programme, just to give you an idea.
Sandhurst is embarking on one of the Army's biggest gender integration programmes.
Awesome, thank you.
I spent 5+ years of my life working up to this point.
I just love it. I'm kind of a bit patriotic.
To be here and to do this role and knowing that then I'm going to have however many soldiers under my command, I'm just very excited.
Thank you very much.
Ramping up female numbers in platoons and trying to make the academy a better place for women.
We always make jokes that our platoon's better behaved because there's women there.
It helps not single you out.
It gives the men a better perspective as well.
I think a lot of people from, you know, my dad's era will always say that the army's gone soft, but I think it hasn't. It's just prioritised what actually makes people better leaders.
Well, that's Officer Cadet Keira Dent there ending that sequence. And I really like what she says there because she's addressing the kind of criticism that this sort of initiative can attract, that it's a sign of the army going soft or being woke, rather than an attempt to modernise what can be outdated methods and improve operational effectiveness.
So you said earlier 4 months you spent there filming Rosie. What did you actually notice? What are they doing differently?
Well, yeah, we were there around 4 days a week and we wanted to really try and see what the critical mass trial was like from the inside. So that really meant following a particular platoon. We chose 5 platoon and going through their whole junior term, the first term of training. So that means we went out on exercise with them. We went up the Brecon Beacons in Wales. We were on the parade square to see them at crack of dawn, learning drill for the first time. And obviously that forms quite a lot of the course. They do a lot of that. And I certainly noticed there's an increased awareness around the female form and physicality. So, for example, a much greater effort to tailor uniform. Like, there's been lots of talk and conversation around uniform traditionally being designed for men, and then a women's uniform just doesn't fit right and you know, impedes them from doing the job that they're there to do. And in terms of drill, which I mentioned, they look at setting the pace via some of the shorter female cadets. So they'll put them up at the front so there's less danger of overstretching and everyone can match that pace. It varies as they do different forms of drill, but you do see them making an effort in that way. The Academy and the Commandant talk a lot about safer but tougher training. So what that means is, in their eyes, is that training hasn't gone soft or got easier. They think it's just as hard, but they're also putting in place a much more comprehensive welfare provision for cadets alongside it.
So I'm really interested to hear, Rosie, how the men you spoke to reacted to all of this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they may have 30% women in these critical mass platoons, but they're still 70% men. And we need to hear from everyone about how they're finding it. And so we spoke to everyone in the platoon. We spent time with them. We interviewed them. But we really did want to put women at the heart of this conversation. And you do see so many military documentaries which are dominated by men. And there's nothing wrong with that because in many areas, the armed forces do have more men in them. So that's fine. But you might get one woman or maybe two women. And I really wanted to make sure that we were putting women at the heart of this program, and you don't just have them as a sort of support act to what the men were saying, especially, you know, when clearly this policy is designed to try and improve the lived experience for service women. But speaking to the men, they were broadly positive. One of the things they talk about is improved atmospherics in the platoon. But let's hear from them themselves. This is John and Bradley, who were two of the men serving in 5 platoon.
It is a lot better in a mixed platoon, I would say. There's girls at the front, there's girls at the back, then there's lads at the front and there's lads at the back. So you don't notice it as such.
There are some lads that very much don't want females in the army, but I don't have an issue. I think if as long as they pass all the tests that are put in front of them, then there's no reason they can't do just as good a job as a male.
It's nice and honest, isn't it, Rosie? Let's talk a bit about why the Academy brought this in. It's not just a unilateral desire to modernise it, is it? The suicide of the officer cadet Olivia Perks, which I mentioned at the start of all of this, it prompted an Army Board of Inquiry and a coroner's inquest into her death, which led to some pretty damning findings.
That's right. So Olivia Perks was in her third term at Sandhurst when she took her own life. The Board of Inquiry, which looked into the circumstances of her death, criticised welfare support at the Academy, and so did the inquest. And they talked about a culture of staff fraternisation and inappropriate relationships. So there was a lot of criticism. And in the programme, we asked staff who work at the Academy now to talk about the effect her death had on Sandhurst. So the first voice you can hear now is the Commandant of Sandhurst, Major General Zach Stenning.
I think all of us at that time recognised that we'd had failings, systemic failings, in the delivery of, you know, safe and tough training.
We certainly didn't kill Olivia, but we failed to catch her when she fell, and that's a tragic story.
The inquiry that followed described a complete breakdown in welfare support.
and a culture of inappropriate relationships between instructors and cadets.
It was an institution under rightful scrutiny. It was an institution that was being forced to look at itself, both by the army and the nation.
Both here at Sandhurst and the wider field army were really keen to engage and to stop this from happening again.
So Rosie, how did this tragic death and the exposure of those cultural failings, how did it lead to what the Academy are doing today in this critical mass trial exactly?
Well, Sandhurst have brought in a lot of change since Olivia Perks was there. And the service inquiry made 61 recommendations following her death, and 29 of them specific to Sandhurst. And one of those recommendations has led to this critical mass trial. So the recommendation says they wanted to review the culture within the academy with particular focus on training experience and female integration. So the critical mass platoons are a response to that. And we've seen the initial parameters for the trial. And one of the stated aims there is an ambition to shape platoon climate and mitigate those cultures that may develop in male dominated platoons. So that's a bit of insight into the motivation for doing this.
You said about going up the Brecon Beacons and getting really involved. I'm just really intrigued to know for you, what was it like being allowed behind the scenes and getting this kind of access?
Well, I mean, it was great. We kind of came there on the first day. It was snowing. You see this well-oiled machine with all the new cadets arriving, saying goodbye to parents, being sent there and immediately getting wrapped up in the routine of Sandhurst, which is, you know, quite hardcore regime. They're up at 6 a.m. in the morning. They have to sing the national anthem and indeed many other national anthems because they reflect all the international cadets going there. Then they're straight out onto the parade square or out onto on exercise. There's a training area outside the gates where they're there. We did go to the Brecon Beacons. That was for exercise long reach, which I think, I don't know how long it's been running, but most serving army officers will have done long reach. And even though it's in the first term, they'll all remember it's quite a taxing navigational exercise where they're out on the Brecon Beacons for days at a time with very limited sleep. So it's quite full on. I mean, for us, you know, we're obviously not going through the same tests as them, but you get a flavour of it and you see what they're doing and you see all of that. And I think in terms of change, I mean, part of the reason to spend so much time with the platoon was to just observe the critical mass and observe, you know, the kind of changes that brings, which you can only observe over time and by speaking to people. And it's just part of the kind of background and, you know, dictates everything they do. And people, it did seem to be a generally happy platoon, quite a confident platoon. People weren't afraid to... I was going to say they weren't afraid to challenge. I guess they don't really challenge their colour sergeant or their platoon commander, but they do engage in conversation. And actually, one of the most noticeable changes in style is how the instructors and the platoon commanders interact with the cadets. They're really trying to step up and treat them as adults. And to me, it doesn't seem like that's people going soft. It's just a bit more of a mature response. There's less being screamed at. They're very much told exactly what to do and they don't talk back. But they are allowed to ask the odd question. And what they do in terms of punishment, because we saw room inspections, we saw, you know, uniforms being prepped within an inch of life. Everything you'd expect to see at Sandhurst is very much still there. And if it's not right, there are punishments. But rather than, so the kind of things we saw would be they would get 10 press-ups straight away if they didn't have their room in order or their uniform in order. But other than that, what they really do is they try and hit them where it hurts in terms of taking time away from them, because this course is all-encompassing. You know, as I say, they start early. They can be on the go till 11 o'clock at night and they don't get weekends. Weekends do start to come back, but in the first 5 weeks, they're working 6-7 days. And so, yeah, if you get something wrong, they'll tell you you've got to go on show parade, which means rocking up every evening with perfect uniform, which means all the time to get that prepared. So that's kind of the thing that they're leaning on heavily. And it certainly did seem to be having a desired effect in terms of, you know, the discipline and putting people into that place.
Rosie, really fascinating talking to you, and I look forward to seeing the rest of the series. I had a little sneaky peek at some of it, and really, really was really fun and interesting to watch. It's called Sandhurst Women, Leading the Fight, and you can watch episodes 1 and 2 on Thursday, the 26th of September. That is today, if you're actually listening on the radio right now. And it's on BFBS Forces News YouTube channel, or for those overseas, you can watch on BFBS Extra and Catch Up. Mike, you saw the first episode. Did it give you a good idea of the direction in which Sandhurst is trying to go?
Yes, it did. I thought it was very good. And it's very different. I mean, the last time I, you know, had much connection with the Sandhurst rhythm was between about 2008 and 2015. And there, women were treated differently in an organisational sense because they used to have a women's company. So one of the companies, maybe Income and Company or something like that, would be all of the women who were inducted into Sandhurst. And because that, it didn't work all that well because more of them dropped out, the company got smaller and smaller, and certainly in 1 year it had to be dissolved and the women sent into other companies. So clearly, as we were separating the women out into one company and dealing with them separately, didn't really work very well. Almost they were, you know, they must have felt they were being set up to fail. Whereas this is very different. This is integration of women down to platoon level. And it's not only a good thing to do, it also makes for a more grown-up atmosphere in general. I think everybody admits that. And it isn't just a way of tapping into 50% of our talent base in the country. It also helps the army to transform itself towards the sort of army that we know we'll need to have. So yes, you still have to be able to carry your personal luggage up the Brecon Beacons in terrible weather. That is one of the requirements of being a soldier. But as well as that, you've got to be able to do lots of other things which soldiers 20 and 30 years ago, generally speaking, didn't have to do. So it's partly, it's this transformational journey, not just in the sense of diversity and equality, but it's where we need to be going to create a modern army.
Well, now on to money matters and something that's really getting people fired up in the military, the prospect of paying 20% VAT on private school fees from January. Some personnel are even threatening to leave the armed forces if the government pushes ahead, whereas others claim it will put new people off joining in the first place. And we all know, as we've reflected many times here before, there are already problems with recruitment and retention. In a moment, we'll talk to the RAF Families Federation. But first, let's chat to retired Army officer Hamish de Breton-Gordon, who's written very strongly against the government's plans. Hi, Hamish, good to see you. Thank you for waiting to talk to us. And before I get into the nitty-gritty of your thoughts on this, just saw you nodding and smiling in recognition of what's been going on that training in Sandhurst, in particular the Brecon Beacons experience. Can you just give us a very tiny reaction to this, to what it's doing?
Well, absolutely. I remember that Long Reach first exercise. I went to Sandhurst in January. So we were in the Brecon Beacons in February. It was snowing. It was this weather. And, you know, 25-year career stretching across Iraq, Afghanistan and all over the place. I don't think I did anything more physically demanding than on those 3 or 4 days in the Brecon Beacons. I still wake up sometime in a cold sweat thinking about it. But, yeah, great stuff. And absolutely brilliant what Sandhurst and General Zach is doing at the moment. Really major steps forward and good on them.
Well, Hamish, we're here today to talk about this VAT being put on school fees for the military potentially from January. You say the government has betrayed the military, and you've explained it by detailing your own experiences at school. What were they exactly?
Well, absolutely. I think fundamentally it's all about stability. When the men and women of the military are away on operations, what their family are up to is absolutely fundamental. And when it comes to schooling, I went to 4 different schools up to the age of 7 in the UK, Germany, and also Bahrain. My dad served a full career in the army. I then, from the age of 7 to 18, went to just 2 schools, two boarding schools. Well, my parents were deployed all over the world. They had, in that 12 years, they had 9 different postings. So I would have gone to, in total, 13 schools over my career. My education career. And that instability, that moving around, not that the state schools are bad at all, but when you're moving every, you know, year or so, it's very destabilizing. And my own children went to 3 primary schools before the age of seven. They then went to boarding school and stayed in the same school. I actually left the army a bit early. So I have personal experience of paying for school fees myself as a civilian. And I had a good job, but every penny I was spent on the school fees. And but for the army pension, I wouldn't have been able to afford to live. But I think people don't realize that, you know, they think that boarding school is free for military families. It's not. You know, you still pay 50 or 60%, which is a huge amount because, you know, soldiers and airmen and sailors don't earn a massive salary. And the 20% on top, you know, will break the back. And as you say, we know how dreadful military housing is. You put this on top, and for our men and women that we expect to be, you know, around the world defending us, you know, if they're worried about their families, they're not going to be on it. And it's, again, as I've said in the Telegraph, I think it's going to severely affect recruiting and retention.
Yes, let's bring in the director of the RAF Families Federation, Maria Lyle. Maria, in your consultation, you've already heard from people who've decided to leave the RAF. What are they telling you? Because there is a personal and a potential operational impact, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as Hamish mentioned, people make this decision for a number of reasons, but key to it is the fact that a mobile lifestyle in the military disrupts their children's education. This has particular pinch points. So if you're talking about dual serving couples, we're very keen to try and retain both men and women in our armed forces. They may not be male and female. Any dual serving couple could be sending their children to boarding school. And that means you may not just lose one, but two members of the military if they feel they cannot maintain their family life in the way that they're doing at the moment. It also means that if you are serving overseas and you're in a location where there is simply no English language option for children beyond a certain age, then you have to use a boarding school. And those posts are often more senior ranks, more experienced personnel doing influential jobs on behalf of the British Defence. So if we lose people going into those roles because they can't afford to pay for their children's school fees, that's really important given what's going on in the world at the moment and how we expect our staff to influence on our behalf.
Yeah, Mike, I just want to get your thoughts on this, because if the VAT does go ahead, surely this flies in the face of the Armed Forces Covenant set up to protect personnel from disadvantage as a result of the nature of their work in the military.
Correct, yes. I mean, it's exactly what the Covenant was designed to try to safeguard the military against. I mean, the government's view on VAT, on school fees, is that, you know, parents choose to send their children to private schools and there are fees, and that it's not unreasonable, say the government, for them to pay VAT on those fees. But the point is, in armed services, you don't just choose to send your children to boarding school. Your career requires you to do it in most cases. And so it's not as if most service personnel have got much of a choice about this if they're going to have any sort of family life. So I think there is without reversing the whole policy, if that's the government's policy, there's got to be ways in which the government can make exceptions in the case of armed service personnel. And, you know, sadly, we're not talking about so many people these days. You know, we're not talking about, you know, so many people across the population. We're talking about a very specific section of people who require the boarding school arrangement in order to have any sort of family life that's consistent with their military.
Well, in response, the Navy Families Federation pointed out the planned implementation of the new rules midway through the academic year means many service parents may not be able to give a term's notice, which could have huge repercussions for them and their children. The Army Families Federation gave us a detailed response and also pointed out the reliance their families have on the continuity of education allowance to pay school fees, and that it needs to be reviewed in time for 20% VAT being added to school fees. Maria, where are we at with consultations on this by the Treasury and the MOD, and when is there going to be any kind of outcome on this?
Well, I wish I could answer that question in full, to be honest. There has been a number of responses that have gone in. The consultation to Treasury is now closed, so they will be looking at those responses that have gone in. Staff at MOD are well aware of the issues, and we've been flagging them up since day one. So there's a remuneration team at MOD who deal with a lot of these issues, and we've been giving them both the sort of the hard facts and evidence, as well as these vignettes about people who are saying, I'm going to have to leave, you will lose a doctor in my service. So in terms of dates, we don't have a date, and that is a plea that we would ask government, that includes Treasury and MOD, for some sort of surety so military families can rest easy that they're going to be able to afford the bills in the next few months.
Hamish, just finally to you, if you were considering joining the army now, would this put you off?
Ultimately, no, because, you know, I think service of the country is so important, and that's ingrained in my psyche, and my son will be the fifth generation to Breton Gordon to join the army. But what I would say, I got a lot of reaction to my piece, and a lot of people saying, oh, this is just an officer's bonus. That's absolutely rubbish. It's open for everybody. When I was commanding the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, I encouraged everybody, and the uptake in the other ranks was huge. And somebody who did a report on this for the Sunday Express told me the other day that the biggest uptake is in the sergeant rank, not the officer rank, which makes a lot of sense. So saying this is just for officers is rubbish. It's all about stability of education and making sure that army families are properly looked after when those people who are defending the country are out doing that job and doing a fantastic job.
This is something we're going to be following with interest. Thank you so much, Hamish de Breton Gordon, Maria Lyle, thank you for your time. It's a sobering fact that more than 100 years after the First World War, to this day, more than 500,000 soldiers are still missing, a third of whom are thought to be buried as unknown. 2 years after the end of the Great War, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was established at Westminster Abbey and has served as a focal point for the public's grief ever since. Now, as Remembrance Sunday approaches, a new book and theatre tour explore the history of that tomb and the painstaking efforts of finding, identifying and reburying the fallen. It's written by former Tornado navigator and best-selling author John Nicol. And we also are joined along with a veteran who served in the army for 30 years, Colonel Lindsay McDuff, who was involved in more than 200 repatriations from Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome to both of you. John, how did this plan take shape for one person to represent all of the missing? And who was this unknown man?
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me back on again. So in the aftermath of the First World War, with just over 1 million dead on the battlefields, and as you say, just over 500,000 missing. So that's missing, never found, so lost to the mud, blown to smithereens in artillery barrages, or missing, buried unknown. And many of the listeners will have been to the great battlefields and the great war grave cemeteries. That famous quote, a soldier of the Great War, known unto God. There was a huge sense of loss in the country in 1918 and a couple of years, a massive sense of loss, a massive sense of grief. What we would probably refer to now as no closure. If you imagine, if you were, this is not the days of mobile phones and signals and emails. Mm. What many people would have had at some point during the war from 1914 is a simple telegram saying, regret to inform you that your husband, son, brother, Private X, Corporal Y, is dead, or is missing, presumed dead. And that would be it. They might get a few letters from friends saying, I saw him go down, but we never saw where, or something like that. But over 500,000 families had no information. So nothing. They didn't have anything. Can you imagine that for us now? And so one man, Reverend David Railton, who's a padre on the front line, an incredible man. He'd won the Military Cross at the Somme. A padre had won the Military Cross at the Somme for his bravery. A man who carried a Bible and not a rifle. He had buried hundreds, perhaps thousands of the dead of his regiment, of his units. He'd striven through the whole of the war to try to tell the families, the loved ones, where I buried your loved one, where I buried your husband, where they are. This is how we identified him. And he... early 1916, he'd been really affected by one thing. He'd been at a battle near Armentières, and he'd gone back to his billet, which was in a bombed-out building, a bombed-out little house on the edge of the village. And somebody had buried one of the dead in the garden. And he said, I went into the garden, I can't remember the exact words, but he said, I went into the garden, and there was buried, there was a grave, and it was marked with a simple cross, and it said, an unknown soldier. And interestingly for Lindsay, in actual fact, in brackets underneath, it said, of the Black Watch. Mm. And that was it. And Reverend Railton, David Railton, said, "Who is this man? What is his family thinking? What will they be saying in the valleys and the glens all those miles away?" And he resolved to do something. In 1920, 2 years after the war, he did something. And he wrote to the Dean of Westminster Abbey and he said, "This is my plan. We'll bring back one unknown soldier." It became unknown warrior to represent the Navy and the Air Force. One unknown comrade to represent all of the missing, to try to quench the flow of guilt, the flow of sadness. And he said that in October, that plan was put into operation in October 1920, just 3 weeks before what we now know as Remembrance Sunday or Armistice Day, the 11th, the second Armistice Day. And it all happened in an incredibly short space of time. And that story is an astonishing story.
And you write about how that warrior was chosen. How did it happen exactly?
Well, so there are a number of different accounts, but the man who was at the centre of it was Brigadier General Louis Wyatt, who was at the headquarters in St. Paul. So he was in charge, his director of graves registration. They were recovering the dead from the battlefield. And you've got to remember, Kate, that they were still tens of thousands. So I've just dug out some figures. In the aftermath of the war, they were recovering tens of thousands of the dead that were scattered, either not buried or buried in shell holes or something like that. Even after the war, 1921 to 1928, they found another 28,000 bodies. 28,000 that had never been registered. But Louis White was in charge of this process. And what he did was he sent out four teams to the four great battlefields, Ine, Ypres, Arras, and the Somme. And they were directed to disinter. So they'd been previously interring, burying the dead. They were directed to find a body that had no identification on it, that was marked as unknown, bring four unknowns back to my headquarters, which they did. Put the four unknowns on stretchers in the little chapel at St. Paul. And at midnight on the 9th, General Wyatt went into the chapel, and he says in his little memoir, in his little writings, he said, "I selected one, we placed it in the coffin and screwed down the lid." Now, some people say he was blindfolded and did it. Nobody knows. Nobody knows how it happened. He says, "I selected one." So he selected one from four, from over 500,000. And that body then was treated with great reverence, and that became the unknown warrior, transported to Boulogne at the head of an astonishing parade of tens of thousands of troops, of French troops, children, to HMS Verdun at Boulogne Harbour, taken over the channel with great ceremony, transported through the dark of the night on the 10th to Victoria Station, where it laid guarded by the Grenadier Guards until November the 11th, which was Armistice Day, the day the new cenotaph that we know now was being unveiled, and the unknown warrior's burial became part of that ceremony. So it was an astonishing feat of logistic organisation and ceremony and pomp.
Yeah, it was quite, and the rest is history, as they say. Let's bring in Lindsay McDuff now. Lindsay, you served 30 years in the Army, and you also served in the Black Watch, as John mentioned there. You're now a colleague at BFBS. I said earlier you've been involved in more than 200 repatriations. That was between 2008 and 2010. Can you tell me a bit more about the value and the pressure of that role?
From the team I was part of was really crucial in making sure that from the point of death or injury, those soldiers were looked after, and that they were ultimately, if they had died, they were repatriated. And back to John's point about having closure, I remember the awfulness, but also the compassionate way in which the repatriation ceremonies were done, where the families of the fallen were gathered together and able to welcome back their lost one, something that many, as you've heard, weren't able to have, and then to hand them on to the family for their burial or cremation further on was a huge honour. And as someone, as a soldier who'd spent most of my first half of my service on deployment, I had no understanding or comprehension about the amazing work that's done to deliver this and support it, particularly with the Joint Compassionate and Casualty Cell, who do a spectacular job, not just in looking after those that have recently fallen, but also those that have fallen some many years ago.
And Lindsay, I mean, the work never stops, does it? Because you are about to attend the reburial of two British soldiers who fought in the Battle of Loos in the First World War. Some 30,000 Scots took part in that battle with thousands of fatalities. I mean, that must really resonate with you. Can you tell us a bit more about this reburial?
Well, it's quite remarkable that they have identified which regiment the individual belongs to. And what's really touching is that soldiers from my regiment will be carrying his coffin and reburying him. I've done a number of those, and even when you're not connected to the person, it is an enormously emotional and privileged thing to be able to do, to witness that, and also to pay our respects to those that have fallen. And what I think John is doing brilliantly is telling the story. And in John McCrae's fab poem, which is called In Flanders Fields, there's a great line which is about from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. And I think what John is doing brilliantly is holding the torch high so that people's stories are being told, so that people understand just the lengths and extent to which people work hard to pay the appropriate respects for those people that have paid the ultimate sacrifice.
Thank you to both of you. John's book, The Unknown Warrior, is out now. And Lindsay McDuff, we look forward to your reports from Loos on all BFBS platforms. And there's much more to my conversation with John Nicol and Lindsay McDuff, including the story of the father who had 55 long-buried bodies exhumed in a failed attempt to identify his missing son. You can hear the whole thing in an extra edition of the SITREP podcast online now. Mike, really important what comes across there is to actually honour the war dead, even if it's like many, many years later, and conduct those reburials. Have you ever been to one yourself?
No, not to a reburial. I've been to a few of the other ceremonies one way or another. But I thought you're absolutely right. And John Nicol is very right that the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior, or the Unknown Warrior when he was being transported back to his resting place in Westminster Abbey, was treated with enormous reverence. And Britain was the first to do it in 1920. France followed in 1921. And I checked up on this for something else I was doing a couple of years ago. There are 57 countries around the world that have an Unknown Warrior. The idea caught on. And they go from A to Z. They go from Argentina to Zimbabwe. And it's very important that these people's identities is never known, because the Unknown Warrior in Westminster Abbey and all of his unknown namesakes are a sort of constant and silent witness to the collective grief of a whole society involved in war. It's very important to honour that and understand it.
Indeed. And Mike, thank you. And thank you to all of our guests. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye for now.